Somewhere across the bifrost, way up high.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost. My name is Sung Soo, and joining me as always is my good friend and dear co-host Pat Dunford. And today, we're not talking to most of our audience, which is a little weird. We're talking and really want to focus on helping new players get into the game. As the world has kind of opened up more and more, I've had more questions about what is this game, why do you like it, where to start. But before we get too far, Pat, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks, TT. And I'm really glad we're doing this episode. Like you, I've had a bunch of people message me, friends from other game systems or people who are looking to get into the hobby. And they have a lot of questions about how to play MCP, what they should know to get started. And I think it's going to be really helpful to have this resource available for those new players.
So there's all sorts of information out there, but at a high-level game, obviously MCP is an alternating activation skirmish game focused in the Marvel Crisis Protocol universe. And before we dive in, Pat, I'm going to throw you a curveball. It's not on the outline. What drew you to MCP initially?
It was a combination of factors. It was the theme and the rule set, which for me are probably the two most important parts of a minis game. I suppose there's three, right? The third is the quality of the models themselves, and MCP checks that box as well. I think the theme is brilliant. I enjoy the comics, and obviously I've become a big fan of Marvel thanks to all the movies. I think the game mechanics are top-notch. Very simple to start learning, very simple to pick up, and then with a lot of depth and strategy behind the scenes. And the models are superb, and they just keep getting better and better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great thing. For me, it was just Captain America. It was a Captain America character. I was just sold. And then, in addition, we know some of the people involved in the company from our times in War Machine and Hordes, and I have a great deal of respect for the Wills in particular, and their ability to kind of transfer everything they know and have learned into a game. I had a lot of confidence there. So, Patreons, this episode might sound a little redundant. Hopefully there's some good information here for you. And we do want to say that the after the credit scene, which is a Patreon-only exclusive, is focused on the single elimination list review. So we're going to dive a little bit deeper, and that'll be a bit of a longer after the credit scenes. But patrons, thank you so much for humoring us here. So for going into this conversation, Pat and I are going to assume that you have played a couple games of MCP, or are at least semi-aware of how the rules go. We don't want to bore you and just read the rule book to you. We're going to go over some basic tips for it. We're going to talk about the very popular question about where do we recommend people buy in, and then kind of some early expansions to go through. Do you think there's anything else we should cover here, Pat, or do you think that's a good overview?
I think that'll be plenty. Look, we're not going to be able to cover absolutely everything that a new player wants to know, but we should be able to at least get some, give you the basics. And what I'd say is if you think there's some more burning questions that we didn't cover, please give me or TT a shout and we can maybe do a follow-up or just go into more detail.
Yeah, so let's start with some general tips for playing the game, right? And I think one of the big things that confuses people at first is the movement rules for the game. Because what ends up happening is you get the base at the end of the movement, both on a place and a normal advance, right, Pat?
Yeah, and in general, MCP has some unorthodox rules for how you move models and how you measure things. I think depending on game systems you might have played before, you'll have certain expectations on how minis games should work with measuring. And for example, using prescribed tools is unconventional for people from some games. And the concept of measuring from any point on a base and then moving the whole base to the end of a measuring tool is also pretty unconventional.
So what we mean by this, just to illustrate it, which is a super great illustration on a podcast, is we have the range 5 ruler, which is a 10-inch ruler. So your model doesn't move 10 inches. They move 10 inches plus the length of their base tacked onto the end of it. So when you're dojoing and workshopping these things in your head or eyeballing it, not only is it the movement tool, but it's actually a little bit of the base on the end as well. And one of the things I like about it is it does make pre-measuring in the game a lot harder, right? You're able to kind of guesstimate where you're going to land, but there's still a little bit of risk involved with whether you can make it to a certain area.
Yeah, now, of course, you can use movement tools to pre-measure, so the single movements are really easy to pre-measure, but the ones that get really tough are when you need to do a couple of movements. And one of the interesting things about the game that you quickly learn is the distance of where the crisis objectives are set up on the table is really, really important. And most characters can't reach crises with a single move. And depending on where the crisis is, you might find it's out of bounds on turn one to your strategies.
All right. So are there any other tips for movement we want to cover in general, Pat? I think that's just a good high-level one to hit.
So obviously, long move is valuable in the game. But I'd say it's really good when you're starting out, just put down the movement tool you're going to do, take a look at it before you move the model, see if they can get to where they need to be. And then aside from that, don't be too surprised if you have to make multiple movements on the first turn. It's pretty normal.
So speaking upon that, I do think it's important to touch on that the game is naturally skewed to favor the attacker, right? That's clearly illustrated in the dice math where there's one additional face that benefits the attacker. In addition, there's a lot more synergies that are going to add dice to you than are going to add the value of defensive dice. And just with the nature of the way the game works with the opposing rolls, right? A spike on an attack is worth so much more than a spike on any given defense roll.
Yeah, and that's just because if you roll higher defense than your opponent rolled attack, that doesn't give you any extra benefit, right? If TT attacks me and gets one success and I get five blocks, well, I've suddenly got one damage. Whereas if you spike high on attack, you can end up daisy or carrying a character in a single go.
Yeah, so we always want to keep that in mind. I see a lot of people that want to build super tanky or defensive teams. I don't know if you get those questions anytime, Pat. And while it is doable, right, a couple spikes either way and your kind of turtle can come crumbling down.
Yeah, this is not a game where some models are immune to others, right? There are some games where certain types of model can only be hurt by specific things. This is not one of those games. Every model can hurt every other model. And this is not a game where survivability is very easy to quantify and predict, and you could say, okay, I think my model can take five hits, so I can expect that this one character's activation can't possibly kill them because they only make three attacks. And it doesn't work like that. Because of the nature of the dice math, you can get very big spikes, and any character can be taken out by any other character.
Yeah, it's a great point to go over there. So keeping that in mind with the attacking in favor, I do also want to talk about the value of attacking versus defensive dice, right? Obviously, the attacking dice is worth more. And we kind of went over this in the recent Carnage box review, didn't we, Pat? Where people make a really big deal out of defensive number values. And for me, ultimately, I care about them less and less unless they're utilized for something else like meteors or traps, the crisis, where you need those specific values.
Yeah. Attack dice tend to matter a lot more than defense dice because you tend to have more of them and each one individually is better. It's not to say that defenses are irrelevant, but you should consider defenses as a way of slowing down the amount of damage you get, not completely ignoring it.
So with that in mind, obviously double attacking is something that's really important, right? In this game, most characters are given two actions. They can perform any given action they want twice, again, most of the time, unless there are other rules. But anyway, double attacking is important. And what we want to talk about there is you never want to end your movement just setting your opponent up to activate someone to attack twice back into you. And you want to maximize your chances of activating any given model and having both of their activations be attack actions. You just end up with a lot more value on it, especially in the early game where people tend to play really passively or cagey sometimes, right? If you can maximize and get some double attack activations, this always seems to be a good benefit for the beginning player.
Yeah, and like we could go deep on this topic, right, and talk about when it's right to attack and when it's wrong to attack. And I think we might cover that briefly, but without going into a huge level of detail. But you're right, at face value, usually you want to be attacking whenever you can. And actions are one of the most precious resources you have in the game. You only have so many characters, they only have so many actions per turn, there's only so many turns in the game. And each action is really important. So you certainly want to be getting the most out of them. And generally that means only moving when it benefits you, right? So moving to get into range to attack, moving to be on an objective, moving to escape from danger, and spending as many actions as possible doing those attacks to deal with the opponent and further your game plan.
Yeah, and I guess let's touch on that real quick. Pat, when do you think it's a good time to attack versus when isn't it?
So one of the most important aspects of Marvel Crisis Protocol that is relatively unique to it. There aren't many other games that use this mechanic. Is power, right? You get power on your characters at the start of every turn. They generate power from doing things like making attacks, which is one of the reasons why attacking so often is so valuable. And very importantly, they get power when they receive damage from enemy effects. So if one of your characters is attacked, they get the power that they suffer in damage. So what this means is the game has an inbuilt comeback mechanic, where if I attack and damage you, you get powered up and you can do better, more impactful things to me in retaliation when it's your activation. And because it's an alternating activation game, that activation could come immediately afterwards, right? And so this is the main thing that you need to consider when deciding who you're going to attack and whether or not you want to attack at all. Is what you're going to achieve with your attack going to outweigh the benefit that your opponent's going to get from the damage they take? Like, how punishing is it going to be to give that target more power to attack you?
Yeah, right. So obviously it's a comeback mechanic, right? It's a mechanic to help you offset with the fact that your character was just pummeled into the ground or dazed or something. And because of that, the game has a kind of natural ebb and flow, right? Where someone gets up early because they spike or they're able to take someone out. But then when that player activates those characters, whether they're high on power and not dazed or coming out of the dazed turn, they tend to have a really impactful swing the other way, right? And that's kind of the natural flow of the game. And I know that catches some people off guard, right? A lot of tabletop wargamer just straight attrition where there's no comeback mechanic at all, and you kind of get up in those games and then you're able to just play cagey and win your way down. In MCP, that's not really the case. If you get up early on attrition, expect a big crackback and always keep your eye on the scenario.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a really good point. And one of the things that separates Marvel Crisis Protocol from some tabletop games, especially the bigger war games, is oftentimes those big tabletop war games are these games of attrition. And Marvel Crisis Protocol is much more a game about tempo, where you have this I go, you go system, and every action you do is generating you some sort of advantage in the game. You pass them back and forth, and you're trying to have your advantage swing bigger than your opponent. You're not necessarily trying to wipe out their models. You're trying to achieve something important, which is usually revolving around the victory points.
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing to keep in mind and can sometimes be hard for people to realize, right? A lot of times you end up with, like, these bad beat stories, right? Oh, I was up so much in attrition, but they beat me 16-8 on scenario. And you're like, well, that doesn't sound like an actual close game, right? Because a lot of times you're willing to give up some attrition pieces if you're able to maintain the crisis advantage, right? Which is ultimately the way that we win the game. What percentage of games do you think are won just by tabling, Pat?
I think it's tiny. My own experience is maybe 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 20, maybe 1 in 30. And I think at some point I saw some stats from some tournament somewhere that suggested it was around 5% of games.
Yeah, 5% sounds reasonable, right? I mean, that would be 1 in 20, and that's probably about where I am. And I've played some really grindy lists over the time, right? But even Black Order or Brotherhood, right? Normally I get up in attrition, I just leverage the scenario to the win, as opposed to just like chasing characters willy-nilly around the board.
Yeah, and especially because the speed of most crises is such that when you're starting to win, it's just faster to win by scoring victory points than it is to try and chase down opposing characters or to finish them all off. It will just naturally play out in most games, especially close games, that, well, actually, even if they're not close, it will tend to be that the speed of scoring is such that the game naturally lends itself to being concluded by victory points before all the characters get wiped out.
Yeah, victory points is just more of a sure thing as well, right? The dice in MCP are, I'll say, not super reliable. They're not as skewed as some other games. And with characters being able to run away and you having to be able, if your only plan is to table your opponent, right? If they have one character live, you just end up getting, right? There's nothing you can do about it. It doesn't matter, right? Whereas playing for the scenario, if you run out of rounds, right? We just go to the score and whoever's up in score is going to win. So it's just a little bit more reliable way to win as well.
Yes. I mean, this is a game that goes for as many turns as you want if the tie is even. And generally speaking, it says the game lasts 6 turns, but it doesn't, right? Your average game probably lasts about 4 turns because you can score points very quickly and the game ends when someone first reaches 16. So the pacing of the game is such that it can often feel like a very fast-paced game where every action you take really matters. because staying ahead of your opponent in victory points is so important.
Yeah, that's a great point. So keeping an eye on the scenario, always super relevant. Read the different scenario things. Be sure to know whether you have to stand on the points, if you have to tap the points, if there's a limit to the number of crisis a character can hold. But again, really keep an eye on scenario. When I talk to new players getting into the game, I recommend they play the same scenario as often as they can, just so they really get a hang of it and slowly expand more. I mean, there's all sorts of different ways to do it. But really, I mean, scenario is the name of the game. Keep an eye on them. So I did want to cover, Pat, real quickly, how do we value and rank, I know we don't rank them, but rate superpowers as we kind of read through them? Are there certain things we look for?
Yeah, definitely. So just to be super clear for those people that are listening and are new, because this is a common point of confusion for people who are brand new, you have attacks that characters make, which are at the top of their stat card and have the physical, energy, and mystic symbols, and they have like a set number of attack dice and a cost. And then below that, you have the superpowers. And the superpowers tend to cost power and do a special effect, or be innate and always be an effect. And I just wanted to call that out because sometimes when you're brand new, you can get confused. You know, is my Captain America shield throw a superpower or an attack? It's an attack. So superpowers can be really influential. And one of the reasons superpowers can be really influential is because they can have really big effects. And often those effects don't require actions to use. So having effective superpowers can be a way to get more out of your character than you otherwise would do, and can be one of the best ways to leverage that advantage of having more power and to use that comeback mechanic if you're behind.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And good call out there, separating the difference between attacks and superpowers. So I think there are a couple different areas that we could lump superpowers into, and we're not being super exact here. And I think we all kind of value these, right, Pat? And I'm going to go over real quick, right? One is movement effects, whether friendly or enemy, right? We're talking about being able to place your own character within a certain range. We're talking about being able to bow to the will of MODOK and enemy's character. But movement effects for characters, I think, have a high value on them. A separate category for throws, right? Throws can move characters, or they just move pieces of terrain, causing a guaranteed amount of damage. And then rerolls. I think those are the three areas that I normally tell people, hey, if you focus on these things, you'll probably end up with a pretty decent collection of characters by the end of the day.
Yeah, and in particular, like the powers that move you without costing an action are great because they're so equivalent to an action, right? And throws often are the equivalent of forcing an action on your opponent, where you throw them off an objective and they have to move back on in their activation. There's so many different superpowers in the game, but I think you're right. Often the best ones on characters are definitely moves and throws. And then having any kind of way to improve your dice is really valuable in the game because, as we discussed before, the dice in MCP are pretty spiky and anyone can hurt anybody else. So if you can make your dice more reliable, then you could be much more effective on the table.
Do you mind going into a little bit more detail about why we value throws more than we value attacks, normally speaking?
So it's mainly because throws in general don't cost an action. Right. So like, there are some attacks that also throw, and those attacks are good. But it's really nice to have throws as superpowers, which are very common, but that don't cost actions, because you have so much freedom in how you use them. You can do things like double move your character on turn one onto a secure objective, throw an opposing character who's contesting it away, and now you're scoring that objective. It gives you a lot of control. But with throws in particular, you can also convert that into damage by throwing terrain or throwing characters into each other. So they're very versatile as well as being powerful.
One of the things that I've always just loved about it the most personally is right that guaranteed amount of damage we're able to get out of there. It just makes, you know, if you like to have a predictive amount of damage, it's a little bit more reliable than taking some larger attacks. And just to clarify, because Pat mentioned it real quick, when we talk about moving your opponent or throwing your opponent, costing them an action. We're talking about this action trading economy, right? In theory, they want to be wherever they were initially. So by us moving them off that point, they're going to spend an action to move back to it. So we do want to keep that in mind, right? Eye on the scenario. We never want to throw them into a more advantageous position for them, which has definitely happened in many games.
Yeah, and indeed, it's not the right way to spend your power to just throw somebody if it's not going to damage them and it's not going to move them to a place that is unhelpful for them, right? You're probably better off using that power some other way.
Yeah, so one of the last things I want to talk about here as we kind of evaluate cards and things on the cards is we talk about two different categories of attacks. We talk about builders and spenders. And at a high level, a builder is an attack that at the end of it or during it has some way to generate your character extra power. They either get power equal to damage done, they get a flat amount of power for every time they make the attack, right? We normally call those builders, as in you're building your character's power. But then the flip side of that equation is obviously a spender. That's an attack that's, right, you spend a bunch of power in order to make it. So how do you put a value on all of these different spenders out there, Pat? Because some of them are pretty impressive if you just read them over.
Yeah, they can often look really impressive, but it can be hard to know how often you're going to get to use them in a game because your power is such a limited and precious resource. So generally speaking, most of the time, you should expect that your characters are making builder attacks. Because for the vast majority of characters in the game, they don't have enough power to use all their effects without making attacks. Or indeed, they only have attacks and no good way to spend their power outside of that. So it tends to be that characters get in this cycle of making attacks that build power and then finding ways to spend it. And some characters will be very simple, and they might only have one or two ways to spend power, and it'll be very obvious how you're supposed to do that. But then for others, they might have a lot of options for how they spend their power. And it might be a really tough question, right? Whether you use that on a really powerful attack that costs a lot of power, or if you save it for some of your superpowers.
So we're evaluating a spender. We're really just, one of the ways that we're looking at it is just, like you said, how often and how realistic is this for us to be able to utilize this attack one or multiple times per game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, there's some examples here that I want to show you. So it's really hard to quantify this as a rule because it really depends on the character and the opportunity cost of spending their power, right? So I'll give you a couple of examples. So a character that has a really great spender that they hardly ever use would be MODOK. Okay, MODOK has a Doomsday Chair. This is a attack that costs 3 power and lets him do a 7 dice physical attack on a target and then a second 7 dice physical attack on an ally near them, right? It's one of the most powerful effects in the game. I don't think anyone else can reliably do 7 dice to 2 targets, like guaranteed. It's really great. But MODOK doesn't use it very often. And the reason he doesn't use it very often is firstly, he's got a great builder attack, his Psionic Blast, which does 6 dice of damage, so nearly as much, and gives him a ton of power. And he's got loads of other ways to spend his power. He can spend it to reroll attack dice, reroll defense dice, move characters, throw terrain. And so for that reason, even though his spender is great, he won't necessarily use it in a game because he's got other ways to spend his power that you might prefer. Now, another example on the other end of the spectrum is Iron Fist. This is a character whose spender costs 8 power, which at face value is ridiculous. And you think, why would I? Like, it's a great attack, obviously, it's superb, but 8 power, how am I ever going to get that? But then you look at the rest of his kit and you realize, hold on, Iron Fist has literally no other way to spend his power. So he becomes like a clock, right? He's going to tick up power, and at some point he'll have 8, and he'll use his Iron Fist, and that's his game plan. So he's a character that will reliably use his spender attack whenever he can, because it's literally the only way he has to use that power. So it really depends on the character and the strategy you're using to determine how often you use those effects. Did you have a specific guideline in mind in regards to, generally speaking, how often you use spenders versus builders?
No, I don't. I think the examples you gave are interesting. I never like using MODOK as an example because he breaks a bunch of rules for me. While I agree MODOK doesn't use his spender a lot, he has a lot of opportunities to, right, because he's so great at generating power.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of characters out there, I'll mention Iron Fist, who can struggle to generate power a little bit, either due to the type of attack he has, the range of the attack, right? But when he does get power, like you said, there's really nothing else he wants to spend it on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I... I just think it's important to, when you're evaluating these big attacks, to be realistic about, okay, am I actually going to utilize this? And if I do utilize it, when am I going to be able to get it, right? It's easy to look at these things as kind of like a pie in the sky ability. I think Doctor Strange is a great example, right? Where, what's the name of this? Is it Crimson Bands? Is it Crimson Bands?
Crimson Bands of Cytorek.
Right. Fantastic power, right? We all agree it's a great power, but he has so many ways to spend power that in my opinion, he doesn't utilize that as often as some other characters would.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of attacks that look great, but you just realize your character is always wanting to spend their power on other things. And there's some other attacks that look pretty marginal, but you realize your character has enough power that you're going to end up using them anyway. So it really depends on the characters and how they play.
Yeah, I actually think the Espionage, which was a pretty boring attack when I read it off of Mystique, is a builder that I find myself using all the time because she just doesn't have a great way to dump power, and it's actually a really nice attack that she ends up with access to, because not because it's a home run, but because she's consistently using this very powerful attack.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes part of her game plan where you expect to be using it several times over the course of a game, even though, on some other characters, they might hardly ever use it.
So I have no idea how this happened. We've talked for 25 different minutes. So we gave you some tips about movement, namely to remember that you're including base length in almost all of these different movement ranges as you kind of workshop and dojo things out in your head. We explained that Marvel Crisis Protocol is at its core attacking favored, and making these impenetrable fortress, super defendy, super tanky lists tends to be kind of flawed by concept, right? At a real base level, if you can maximize the amount of times your characters are going to be double attacking, assuming you still have an eye in the scenario, you're probably going to be coming out of ahead. And we covered basic superpowers that we really value, right? Is anytime we can have movement effects, either for friendly or enemies, bound in the will of MODOK, hook line off of Hawkeye. Throws are extremely valuable for, again, a quote-unquote attack or way to deal damage that doesn't cost us an action, in addition to there being a movement trigger associated with it and a set amount of damage. Rerolls are always a benefit. It's a dice game, right? And then we all have run into that, oh, my dice kind of betrayed me here, right? And whether that's true or not, it's a whole nother conversation. But being able to reroll some of those, get us a little bit more closer to average, always a benefit. And then we talked a little bit about how to evaluate spenders. So that's all the high-level tips we wanted to go into. Next, we wanted to talk about purchases. And one of the big questions, Pat and I haven't talked about this, so I'd love to have conversations like this fresh in the air, is do you think people should start with the core set?
So, yes, I do. And I think as time goes on, as the core set grows ever more distant, and as more releases come out, that answer might change. But it's been, 20 months or so since that set came out? And I don't think it changes yet. The core set gives you 10 characters, 20 team tactics cards, and 6 crisis cards, right? Plus terrain, dice, measures. There's so much value in that set that if you only want a portion of it, it's still worth the purchase. And I think even if you can argue that some parts of it aren't valuable, it's hard to argue that a small enough portion is not valuable that you don't want it. What do you think?
I always tell people to pick up the core set. Now I pretty much agree with you on all accounts, right? It's in America, at least it MSRP is for $100. So the amount of value you get ever, right? By the time you got a dice pack and a set of, I think you called the movements, right? Movement tool and range checkers, we're out at almost $35, right? So for an extra $65, we're picking up 10 characters, which is enough to play the game, right? A bunch of tactics cards to give you kind of a core base and some really valuable crisis cards. I like all the crisis coming out of the core set. They're not the new flashy ones, but they're reliable crisis cards, right? We have Struggle for the Cube, we have Skrulls. Okay, I take it back. I don't like Skrulls. We have Spider Infected, Deadly Meteor, Infinity Formulas, and Riot Spark, right? So all of these crises we see in quote-unquote competitive rosters pretty commonly.
Yeah.
And there are some really nice value tactics cards, right? We have all of the Avengers, not all, most of the Avengers cards, the core Cabal cards, right? And then two just like really unaffiliated superstars with Disarm and Brace.
Yeah, lots of universal cards. I think the crises are excellent. I really like the crisis selection in the core set, and I think it's very rare that you see people's rosters that don't use any of those cards. And I think the team tactics cards, there aren't a lot of ones that are must-haves, but one of the nice things about the core set is it just gives you this foundation where you can start playing and then you can slowly build up a collection. Because if you don't start with the core set, the requirement to have three secures, three extracts, and 18 tactics cards is actually quite a steep one. Team tactics cards are pretty easy to get a hold of. Most box sets will have about three on average. But character box sets will have zero or one crisis card, right? I'd say probably on average, there's one crisis card per four box sets or something like that. So if you're buying the models you want to play with, it's going to be, you'll have to be very lucky to also have six crisis cards come with that selection, right? And I feel like for no other reason, you want the core set just so you have that foundation to build on, rather than then having to target all of your other purchases to make up for that discrepancy.
Yeah, and I really do agree with that. Now, we're going to play devil's advocate here, and I've heard people say, I'm not interested in playing Avengers or Cabal. And at that stage, right, I'm like, okay, I understand a little bit more, you know, as far as any of the characters in the core box being taken unaffiliated or into other affiliations, we're talking a pretty minor subset of them, right? Just really two or three kind of immediately jump to mind. There are definitely some older models which have just kind of fallen out of favor because they're not kind of the new hotness. So if that's really the case and you've determined you absolutely want nothing to do with them, you're going to have to be, exactly what Pat said, you're going to have to be judicious about what boxes you pick up to get to your six crisis limit. And you're going to also have to kind of cherry pick other tactics cards, which you want to, which is certainly a viable way to go. It can just be a little more difficult. So even if you're not planning on playing Avengers or Cabal, I still like it as a pickup. I know $100 is a lot of money for a lot of people out there, but I think it just gives you a nice core foundation that you can kind of build around and go on from there. The one thing I will say is it's actually a really bad core set to split. I don't recommend splitting it. It's kind of a one-person starter.
Yeah, and that I think the reason for that is, once again, it's the cards, right? You can split the models, that's fine, but you need, both players want to have the full set of cards, at least the crisis cards, at their disposal. So I agree, for that reason I wouldn't split it either. What I would say is, even if you don't want to play Avengers or Cabal, like, so every time we get a new affiliation, we have this back catalogue now of a lot of characters, and it tends to be that a bunch of them get added to these affiliations, right? So if you look at the core set, at the time that it came out, it was Avengers versus Cabal, right? But now Crossbones is also part of the Criminal Syndicate, Doc Ock is part of the Spider Foes, Spider-Man is part of the Web Warriors, you know, the list goes on. And as time goes on, you know, that's only going to increase. So even if you don't particularly want to play Captain America versus Red Skull, you can probably find a home for at least a few of the characters in your rosters. And even if you didn't use any of the characters, the box was still worth be getting, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I think we're both in agreement there. But let's pretend that the person doesn't want the core set, right? Are there affiliations you'd recommend to start with? Because a few come to mind for me almost immediately.
Oh, yeah? What springs to mind?
I like Asgard. I like Wakanda. And I like Web Warriors a lot.
So they're all cool affiliations full of heroes. Why do you like them the best?
I feel like all of them have a decent amount of characters that people end up taking as either a second affiliation, a splash affiliation, so to speak, or as unaffiliated characters filling out rosters later on as you kind of mature. So I just think you kind of get extra value out of those characters, right? Asgard, right? The Thor Valkyrie box. Valkyrie is obviously just a powerhouse. In addition, right, they come with some really powerful crisis cards out of there. If you end up picking up Angela, right, or an Enchantress, right, just another super powerful box you see out of places a lot. Wakanda, same thing, right? We have the Corey Shuri box, which has great value, and then Black Panther is kind of used all over the place. And to wrap us up, Web Warriors has just obviously fan-favorite characters in them. Some pretty good cards, right? All You've Got comes out of the Miles Gwen box. And those characters as well, I see splashed pretty frequently.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. I mean, some of the things that those three have in common, I don't know if you thought about this, right? But they're all iconic, right? They're all affiliations that are immediately recognizable, that have had plenty of time on the big screen, right? That a lot of people are drawn to because they really love the characters, right? All of the Spider People, all of the Asgardians, all of the Wakandans, right, are awesome. They're all quite small affiliations. You don't need more than a couple of boxes to make any of them work. In fact, I'd say all of them can be strong with just two boxes, plus the core set. And maybe you throw out a third. So they're easy to start with. And They all have really powerful characters that, as you said, can be taken in lots of other affiliations as well as defining the strengths of their own. So, yeah, I agree. All of those are fantastic choices, I think, for those reasons.
Do you think I left any off that you think are worth mentioning?
So you left off some of the more sprawling affiliations like Defenders and Criminal Syndicate. And I think that's probably for the best because I think they don't have that same... Because they're bigger, they have... Like, their iconic characters are a bit diluted by having a bunch of other stuff, and you tend to need more boxes to collect them. And they're not so distilled to just having, like, these two box sets are great characters you'll use anywhere and also define the affiliation. I think what I would tell people is to always pick affiliations that they enjoy, because I think the game balance of Marvel Crisis Protocol is excellent and you're going to do well with anything, especially when you're starting out, right? I mean, who cares what the most powerful is? I mean, you and your buddies are going to play and you're going to have fun and you're going to win some games, you're going to lose some games. And so for that reason, I don't think you can go too far wrong just picking any affiliation you like and then branching out as you learn the game more. But maybe, I think to use my own criteria, the other ones that immediately spring to mind would be X-Men and Brotherhood. Small self-contained affiliations that are really iconic. Now, what I would say is they have fewer characters that are frequently taken in other affiliations. Brotherhood has Toad and Mystique, which see a lot of time in various lists, but they're in two different boxes. And the X-Men are a little bit more corner case, although it should be mentioned that Wolverine is like in half the affiliations in the game. So if you buy it to him, then you can get some use out of him almost no matter what.
Yeah, I think those are interesting additions. And I think for the main reason the users hit on at the end there, I didn't kind of initially consider them, but that certainly shouldn't exclude them from being factored in. And really, I think what Pat said at the end of the day is the most important. And we've all learned this through miniature games, right? I will get my models painted if I like the models I'm playing. Mm-hmm. I will enjoy the game more if I like the faction or affiliation or the characters that I'm getting to play in the tabletop. So I almost never recommend just like, oh, and I'm not picking on Mark Garreau. Mark knows I love him. Mark Garreau says this is the best character in the game. This is the affiliation I'm going to play, right? If you don't like that character, if you don't enjoy playing them, it can be a slog to end up painting it. And then for me, I just end up with diminished value out of playing them.
Yeah. So I think when you take that into account and you also consider that the game balance is really good and pretty much anything is viable, you shouldn't worry too much about picking the best thing. You should just, I'd always say start off small, start off with what you love, add that to the core set, and then go from there.
Yeah, definitely. So after we pick up the core set, are there some other boxes you recommend people grab, normally speaking? And I'm going to take the easy one because I'm directing traffic here. I think Shurian Okoye is a fantastic early box for people to pick up. It gives you a 2 and a 3 threat character who are used out of affiliation all the time. It also gives you 2 Wakandans if you end up wanting to go that direction. There's just a ton of value to me coming out of that particular set.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. It has a couple of really useful tactics cards in that box. The one that immediately springs to mind is Advanced R&D, which is like a staple in so many different rosters and something you can use in basically any roster and have fun with. So I think that's another reason to consider that set. Another set that I would consider would be Angela and Enchantress. Mm. And that's for a similar reason. It's 2 really cool characters that you can fit into lots of different rosters. One's 4 threat, one's 5 threat, right? And so if you had both of those box sets, you have this spectrum of threat ranges covered, where you have a bunch of really amazing characters you can happily put into any roster, and you can fit in different threat levels depending on the crisis that you're playing.
Yeah, the other box I want to recommend right away, and we mentioned before, is actually Thor and Valkyrie, right? Gives you a 5 and a 3. Valkyrie is, you know, in the conversations for the best unaffiliated 3. None of you can see it, but I'm making air quotes with my hands. So just a character you're going to get a lot of mileage out of. If we combine them with the Angela and Enchantress box that Pat recommends you pick up, you're pretty close to running an Asgard roster. It gives you Odin's Blessing, which is just a staple if you want to play Asgard. It also gives you Hammers, which is also known as Fear Grips World as Worthy Terrorized Cities, which is a really commonly played crisis. So I really do recommend the Thor and Valkyrie box.
Yeah. I think that's a great choice. I'm trying to think about what other box sets I've got the most use out of. It's tricky because we're almost coming back to the same point about Asgard and Wakanda and Web Warriors, right? Great characters you wanted lots of circumstances. The one that I was going to name was Spider-Man Miles Morales and Ghost Spider. Two really good three-threat characters that you're happy to run in lots of different places in the game, lots of different rosters, who also defy Web Warriors, and they have a great tactics card in that box in All You've Got.
Yeah, absolutely. And some other character boxes I just want to mention that have great cards in them and some more corner case and more niche characters, right? Gamora and Nebula come with Medpack. I think Nebula is a fantastic choice, a really nice value two hitter. She did some bad things to my X-Force roster the other week. Vision and Winter Soldier. Winter Soldier, not played that much. Vision, an incredible powerhouse, is kind of overlooked. You know, can shine in Brotherhood or Avengers. And Field Dressing is in that box. So just some powerful tactics cards in those boxes for some more niche characters there, Pat. So that's a couple different box recommendations. So to review there, Pat and I both recommend the core set. We understand you might not like Avengers, what's wrong with you? Or you might not like Cabal, that's fine, you're just a good human being. So if you don't like them, there's still a bunch of value you get out of it. The terrain has, in my opinion, a very reasonable price tag coming in this $100 box. We get a set of dice, we get all the movement things, we get this core set of crisis cards, we get these core set of tactics cards. There's still a lot of value in the core set, even if you don't plan on playing those affiliations. We like Asgard, Wakanda, and Web Warriors as first affiliations for you to kind of branch into because they can kind of grow with you and those characters you can take with you to different places and different affiliations kind of down the road. And then other boxes we really love are Shuri Okoye, Angela and Enchantress, and Thor and Valkyrie. So we hope, if you're a new player, that this kind of helped a little bit. I know a lot of the podcasts end up kind of talking over new players' heads, and we're definitely guilty of that a lot of times. We just wanted to take a few minutes, which ended up being, you know, basically an episode worth of minutes, to kind of go over some basic tips and some basic buy-in strategies for new players. So Marvel Crisis Protocol has been out almost 2 full years. Pat and I have really enjoyed almost every moment of that, whether you're playing in person or on Tabletop Simulator. And just locally, at least in Colorado, as the world opens up, I see more and more new players in Colorado popping up.
That's really great. And we're seeing the same in London. It's really fantastic to see how popular the game's been despite the pandemic. And I'm excited to see its future now that we can start to return to normality.
Patrons, we want to thank each and every one of you for humoring us through this episode. If you want to support the podcast or AcrossTheBifrost.com, which I really recommend if you're a new player, jump over to AcrossTheBifrost.com for a full selection of all sorts of different content creators. I just invited 4 more content creators this morning to it, so I should see a lot more videos and a couple more blog articles. If you want to support the podcast or that website, you can jump on over to Patreon.com/AcrossTheBifrost. For $4 a month, you get access to our weekly bonus episode we call the After the Credit Scenes, which is honestly nowadays almost a full episode. It's between 20 to 30 minutes of Pat and I kind of diving a little bit deeper on subjects. And today we're going to be talking about the single elimination cuts for the Tabletop Simulator League. And I think that's going to wrap up this episode. So until next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high, there's a in a lullaby somewhere across the Bifrost, skies are blue and the dreams that you dare to dream really do